U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Is William Barr really thinking of resigning as Attorney General? Plus, Donald Trump issues multiple pardons and acts of clemency. And Bernie Sanders soars in the polls ahead of the next Democratic presidential debate. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, here with my distinguished, more distinguished all the time, colleagues. Kyle Peterson, how are you, Kyle?
Hello, hello.
And Kim Strassel. Kim, hello.
Hello, Paul.
All right. So, Kim, I want you to tell us, based on all your reporting, is the Washington Post and New York Times suggestions that Bill Barr has told intimates and some people close to Donald Trump that if the president keeps up his tweeting about the Justice Department and specific cases, he may feel he has to resign?
Well, in a certain way, of course, those stories are right. I mean, when Bill Barr comes out, as he did last week, and says the president is making it impossible for me to do my job, that was him publicly saying, look, knock it off or I might not be able to stay. Mm-hmm. Everyone has sort of understood this. So in some ways,
except, just let me, sorry for the intrusion. Except some people have said, aha, this was all just part of a scheme by Trump and Barr to somehow deflect from the controversy over Trump's tweets. You're saying that's nonsense.
Which was always ludicrous, right? That's not how Bill Barr operates. And I have no doubt, and I know from my reporting, that his decision to go out there and do that ABC interview was done after a great deal of thought. And because there was an understanding within the Department of Justice and some real worry that we've seen this before. When a cabinet official comes out and tries to send a message to the president to knock it off, that often what happens is it escalates into a big public fight and somebody loses their job and it's not the president. So there was great risk to Bill Barr in doing this. It was not done, you know, without a lot of thought. It was not done easily. Of course, it was not a stitch up. And of course, the point of that entire conversation was that the president needed to think hard, because if he puts Bill Barr in a position where Bill Barr no longer can suggest he has the integrity to do what he's doing there, in particular the Durham report and other aspects of cleaning house at the Department of Justice, there is no reason for him to stay.
Well, the president's initial response publicly to Barr's statement last Friday was to say, I could have intervened with the justice, but I decided not to. So it was relatively muted. Try to get the last word, like your brother at a teenage in a fight that you had with your brother when you were 16 or maybe 13. But he got in that. So then this week, though, he's picked it up again, and he's been tweeting about his authority over the Justice Department. And this week he said that, I think these were public comments, not tweets, I guess I am chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Now, of course, Bill Barr is the chief law enforcement officer, but Barr does work for Trump. So I think the press has overreacted to that. But it's when Trump gets into these specific cases and lobbies publicly to say this should happen, that it creates all kinds of difficulty for Barr to act and to act with credibility, because, of course, the opponents of any specific action are going to say, aha, he didn't make that decision, Trump did.
Well, look, let's be clear. When the president says he's in charge, he is in charge. He's right. If he wants to make these statements, if he wants to order that something happen at the Justice Department, no one disputes that he has the ability to do so. The question is it wise? What is the purpose of this? And in fact, are you undermining your own agenda and your own ambitions? Look, every time Donald Trump opens his mouth and says something about, for instance, Andrew McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI, who the Department of Justice last week decided they would not pursue on claims of that he'd lied to federal officials. Whenever Trump gets into a case like that, he puts judges in an awkward position. He puts Department of Justice officials in an awkward position, and he makes it harder as a result for all those systems and the people who work out there to actually pursue real justice. Look, one of Andy McCabe's claims as he was arguing against charges being brought against him is that he'd been singled out by the president. Well, that is something that will resonate with certain judges and officials. And the president needs to understand that when he does this, he's not helping himself. He's not helping the cause of justice. He's undermining it.
And 1,000 former Justice Department officials, lawyers, signed a letter of protest urging Barr to resign. When my view is, it's the problem in Barr, the problem is the president. And then there was a story about some judges getting together and having an emergency call, which was also inappropriate, given the fact that Judge Jackson, who's handling the Roger Stone case, has total discretion of what sentence to impose. Nobody is questioning her independence or her standing. She can do what she wants. So the last thing we need is a politicized judiciary. Well, the question is this: judges who intervened publicly, Kim. I know you were doing a little bit of background coverage of that as well, suggesting that maybe this was action that was also inappropriate.
Well, these are transparent attempts to try to pressure Bill Barr into leaving his office. They're being done by, in the case of the 1,000 who sent the letter, this was ginned up to a certain degree by liberal groups. It was liberal former employees who signed on to the letter. By the way, a lot of them aren't even attorneys or lawyers. They're just former staff people and bureaucrats who worked at the Department of Justice. So that was a bit of a political stunt. The judges who are getting on a call, that also smacks a bit of politics and is concerning. Now, it's not surprising. We've had a bit of what we've labeled it in the Journal editorial page, resistance judges, folks who have felt the need to use their bench and their power on the bench to push back against Donald Trump. But again, unwarranted in that the judge in this case over Roger Stone, no one has suggested that she has not been completely free and independent to rule exactly as she sees fit, which she will do tomorrow.
What would be the consequences if Bill Barr were to resign? Of course, the immediate consequence would be that Trump would have to have an acting person in charge of the Justice Department while he before nominated somebody else and then had that person confirmed. So you would have somebody with presumably less authority to make difficult decisions, less authority to supervise John Durham. And it may be that it would again make the opportunity of getting out the real story of what happened in 2016 with the surveillance of Carter Page and the Trump campaign, again, it would be counter to what Trump says he wants.
It would be a disaster. I think that chance completely, maybe it entirely disappears. Do not underestimate what a rare and unique gem Donald Trump has in Bill Barr. He is an unusual individual in that he'd done this rodeo before. He was the attorney general previously, so he knows the institution. He's distant enough from it, though, and feels a sense of responsibility great enough that he is willing to take a hard look at it to try to restore its integrity after what he knows was a very black mark on its behavior, given the FBI's 2016 work. And he's also at a stage in his life and his career where he doesn't have to scrabble to try to get the next political job. So he doesn't care in that regard. And, you know, we've said this before, Donald Trump needs Bill Barr a whole lot more than Bill Barr needs this job, and the president needs to understand that.
All right. We're talking about the president and the Justice Department, as well as the Donald Trump's acts of clemency and a preview of the Democratic debate. And you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. So let's move on to the another justice-related event, which is Donald Trump's issuing multiple acts of clemency, commuting sentences for Rod Blagojevich, most prominently the former governor of Illinois, after he had served 8 years of his 13-year sentence, and then pardoning Bernie Kerik, the former NYPD chief, and Michael Milken, the great financier from the 1980s, who served 21 months in prison for some felonies he had admitted to under enormous prosecutorial pressure, including pressure against his brother. There's a lot of flurry about this, Kyle, that somehow Trump is taking over the judiciary branch, but this is well within his authority as commander, as president under the Constitution. The pardon power is one of the most moderated power that a president has.
Yeah, and so the question, I think, is just what Kim said a moment ago, which is whether this is wise. And I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, on one hand, Trump, which is just perfectly aligned with his personality, is unafraid to take some of these actions that may be politically unpopular. I mean, the Journal has been calling for Michael Milken to get clemency since at least 2000. And another one that comes to mind is Trump's act of clemency towards Scooter Libby in 2018, the former chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, who many conservatives thought had been treated really unfairly by the prosecutor and had been calling for that for a long time. And we're very happy to see Trump finally take that action. The downside, again, is that it looks like it's outside the normal process, and it looks like it's a little erratic. I mean, some of the reporting suggests that that Joe Montana and Jerry Rice, the San Francisco 49ers players, were lobbying for one of these pardons. Kim Kardashian.
Well, they were. Well, I'm sure they were. They were. I mean, I think Jerry Rice was in the White House Oval Office with the DiBartolo family, Eddie DiBartolo, the former owner of the San Francisco 49ers in the great 49er heyday. So no doubt he did.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, I do think that it's a problem, the perception that the way to get this clemency through the process now is not to go through the Justice Department, but to get somebody to get on cable TV or to get somebody famous who has the president's ear, who can take your case to him directly.
In the case of Michael Milken's pardon, which I followed the case going back way back when, the first time we supported a pardon from Milken was in December of 2000 when Bill Clinton was considering it at the end of his term. So in my view, this is something that is entirely justified and is far too long delayed, frankly. It would have been great if President Bush or Obama had done this, Kim. Would you agree with Kyle's point, though, about the appearances of this?
I'm going to disagree a little bit, just because I take the view, again, that the power of the presidential pardon is one of the widest. We may have a process set up for it through the Department of Justice, but we all know that process has not been followed in any number of scenarios in times past by other presidents. If you look at the list of people that have been pardoned over time, political donors look at Mark Rich, for instance. That was a Bill Clinton pardon. That there are all kinds of ways to get the president's ear and get attention on this. Also, people are saying, well, it's outrageous, this or that pardon. Presidents routinely engage in outrageous pardons. I thought it was fairly outrageous when Barack Obama pardoned Chelsea Manning, who had leaked very sensitive documents that put people at risk in the United States, to WikiLeaks, and there are others. So it's a huge power. Hey, personally, I was happy that Trump actually did do one thing. He actually waited until the criminal justice system was complete, which is something he didn't do with a prior pardon, that of Joe Arpaio, the sheriff out
right.
of Arizona. And he kind of short-circuited that process. So at least he was dealing with people that truly had gone through the Department of Justice system.
And we should say in the case of Blagojevich, the former governor of Illinois, that he did serve 8 years. So it's not as if and he didn't expunge his conviction.
It was a commutation.
It was a commutation. So 8 years, I mean, even for a governor of Illinois, with a long track record of a lot of governors who've been in the pokey. 8 years is a long time.
That's true. But Trump is running for re-election against a campaign that is presenting him as corrupt, that is presenting him as erratic. And I mean, I with whatever you take each of these cases individually, whatever the merits of them are, it does seem a little bit strange to me that he would do this now rather than waiting to do it in December after getting re-elected.
Well, I guess his response would be, so you want me to do it after safely I'm elected when there's no accountability here. I'm doing it up front. I'm manning up. Sue me.
That's a fair point. Although I think that is assuming more order in the brain of Donald Trump than is perhaps there. I mean, it's the explanations that he gives are interesting. So, I mean, he was talking about these pardons yesterday, talking about the Blagojevich one specifically, and was saying it was a prosecution by the same people, including Jim Comey. He ought to have a better explanation.
It wasn't. It was a prosecution by Patrick Fitzgerald, who is a lawyer for Jim Comey.
Right. So the quote is, it was a prosecution by the same people, Comey, Fitzpatrick, the same group, essentially. But, he ought to have a better explanation that he can give reporters while he's standing on the tarmac with the helicopter behind him about why he did this.
And I guess to Kyle's point, Kim, this plays into the media spin that the Democratic argument that this is Trump unhinged, unleashed after impeachment. And now he's just out of control, like King Kong, having broken the chains and is going to rampage through the countryside. It's exaggerated, but that's the Democratic argument.
Well, look, I think part of the problem, though, is that they almost inspire this to happen, and in that there's a feeling in the White House, and I know this to be the case, that no matter what the president does, he will be accused of everything you just said. Now, there are moments where I think he really does sort of walk off the edge some. But when you have a press corps that every day in and out accuses you of the worst possible things, I think it does in a certain way encourage the White House to say, hey, you know what? We're never going to get credit for restraint. So let's just do what we're going to do.
Okay, let's talk about the president, the Democratic debate in particular. We talked a little bit yesterday about how Michael Bloomberg is going to be in the hot seat, appearing in his first Democratic debate. He'll be the target. We know from the comments that have been made by the competitors already, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, others, that he's going to be the target of attacks for spending so much money on the campaign, for his record in New York. But here's also the backdrop for this debate. Bernie Sanders is soaring in the polls. We now have four polls, national polls, of varying quality, but generally quite good ones, including the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, the ABC Washington Post poll, Emerson poll, another one, that have Bernie Sanders now in the national lead nationally, including 16 points in the post poll, and I think a dozen in our own. So, Kyle, this is the Sanders surge in the wake of Iowa and New Hampshire, and it shows you how winning individual primaries is like an island hopping campaign and can change the dynamics of the national race all by themselves.
That's what I think is going to make this debate so interesting, is that Sanders is obviously the front runner at this point. And some of the campaign's candidates may be tempted to go after him, trying to overtake him. And yet you have this newcomer on the stage, this former Republican mayor coming in, and there may be almost an immune response against him, this billionaire, and they may be directing their fire that way instead of taking on the guy who's really in the position now to be in the lead and to possibly get the nomination. So it's a little bit strange. I'll be interested to see who directs their fire which direction.
Do you think that Kim, Kyle, they should in fact target Bernie as well as Bloomberg? Because I don't think Elizabeth Warren's going to do that. I think she's going to go after Bloomberg. But it's going to be an interesting question to see what Amy Klobuchar does, for example, or Pete Buttigieg. Do they let Bernie and Mike and Elizabeth fight it out and try to rise above, or kind of go and say, I'm a essentially a non-combatant here, and you need me to unite the factions in the party, or are they going to mix it up?
They have to. I don't see any way you can't, because look, step back and what has actually happened in the field. You see Bernie growing his support, consolidating some of support. Undoubtedly, some of that is coming from Elizabeth Warren, who has been struggling. But what you have is the other half of the field, the ones that are meant to represent the more centrist views in the party, that are fighting it out between them. And so if you're an Amy Klobuchar, you need to do two things. You need to, first of all, say why you are the better person to consolidate that vote in opposition to Bernie, and make those distinctions between herself and a Bloomberg and a Biden, but also make the distinctions with Bernie and say, look, you know, we can't let this guy run away with the nomination. We've got to have an alternative, and everyone needs to come around that alternative. Otherwise, we're going to split the vote and he's going to take the nomination.
I think there really is at this stage a danger for these other competitors that Sanders is going, he's going to win, likely to win Nevada on Saturday in the caucuses. He's ahead by a lot in most surveys. Then I just saw a survey in South Carolina. He's now tied with Biden. So let's, and that's the following Saturday, so a week later. So let's assume that he wins Nevada. That's more new momentum in the island hopping campaign. Then he moves on to South Carolina. Bloomberg isn't in that race, so maybe that gives a chance for Joe Biden or somebody else to pop through and stay in the race. And then Super Tuesday is only 3 days later. Sanders is already ahead in California, the biggest state. He's doing very well in many of the other states. He could have he could have a plurality of the delegates, or be on the path to a plurality of the delegates after March 3rd or certainly March 10th.
Right. And part of the issue in the Democratic primaries is that all the delegates are awarded proportionally. So once he builds up a lead, it's very hard to overtake him because it's not as if defeating him in one state is a winner take all and you can take all those delegates away. I mean, as long as he continues to poll relatively well, even if he's not winning, he's still going to get delegates, even if he's not the winner in a given state. And so, I mean, part of what happens may depend on who places second, third, fourth in these states. I mean, if Biden is very far back, he may decide that he's had enough and it's not worth trying to stick it out. On the other hand, if he comes in, you know, second in Nevada, he's got a reason to keep going. Or if Pete Buttigieg comes in second in Nevada, he's got a reason to keep going. I mean, everybody wants to be the alternative. The Bloomberg's aides have a state of the race memo out where they're arguing that if Biden, Bloomberg, and Klobuchar remain in the race despite having no path to collecting delegates on Super Tuesday, they will propel Sanders to an insurmountable lead. So there's Bloomberg, but he's not even competing in these races, and he's saying, "I'm the guy you need to rally around." But he doesn't even have any delegates yet.
Yeah, it's I think the Biden and Klobuchar campaigns would say that's the definition of chutzpah. You didn't even compete in the early races, now you're telling us to get out. Sorry, sir, you shouldn't get in. You're the one who didn't compete. But of course, he's in with the enormous resources, more than $400 million so far as his estimated spending, Kim. Last word on Sanders is Kim, is Sanders in danger of pulling away here?
Absolutely. And again, for all the reasons we were just going through. Look, the Democratic Party is split. You've got part of the party that wants a progressive candidate, and Sanders is rapidly rolling up those votes. And yet on the other side, you've got 3, 4, 5 people that still continue to slog it out for the so-called more centrist vote. And, you know, one of my disappointments, we'll see how he does tonight in the debate. But, you know, Michael Bloomberg did have an opportunity to really distinguish himself from a lot of these other candidates by being the more quirky, a true kind of more centrist candidate that didn't come out along with the rest of them and just adopt all the policies that this whole centrist crowd is adopting. But he is kind of changed all that. And just in recent weeks, we've got, a $5 trillion tax increase proposal, a new crackdown on Wall Street. Suddenly, he's not doing much to distinguish himself from that.
All right. We will see how this very interesting exchange goes on Wednesday evening. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.